This is the Financial Sense News Hour. With the president of PFS Group, Jim Poplava. Since 1982, PFS Group has offered asset management and educational resources that have helped investors build, maintain, and preserve their wealth. And now, our lifetime income experts, Jim Poplava and Kathleen Harris.
Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava.
And I'm Kathleen Harris.
And welcome to this week's edition of Lifetime Income here on the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, this week's show is going to be pretty closely related to the show that we did last week, in case you missed it. Last week on the program, we talked about government benefits, we talked about Social Security benefits, and we talked about veterans benefits with Peter Gravett. He was Secretary of the California Department of Veterans Affairs. Now, this week, we're going to be talking about health care costs, so we're going to sort of be following some of the benefits that are available from the government. We're going to talk about a sister program of Social Security, which is Medicare, which is going to become increasingly more important as you take a look at healthcare costs during retirement. Now, I'm going to be having a conversation with Dr. Georgia Sandler. She is clinical professor of surgery at UCSD's Moores Cancer Center about cancer risk and prevention. And it's amazing because a lot of the things that help prevent heart disease work also in preventing cancer.
You know, Jim and I often mention on this show that the main reasons why I think a lot of us look forward to retirement is because we kind of have this idea in our heads that retirement's going to be a time when we, quote unquote, enjoy life, whatever that means to us. Maybe that means we spend more time with our favorite hobby, or we spend more time with our family. Maybe our grandkids become more an important part of how we spend our time. Maybe we do something else that we really have enjoyed our whole life but not been able to devote much time to. But this is why Jim and I sometimes talk about healthcare related topics in the program, because it seems obvious to us that it's easier to enjoy your life, especially your life in retirement, if you have good health. Now, even if you're healthy now and you're doing all that you can to stay that way, that's not to say that things can't change. Sometimes, you know, medical problems just seem to happen to us. So Jim and I are going to talk a little bit today on the program about different costs, about healthcare and retirement, and things to think about in terms of planning for those costs.
Yeah, because last week we talked about Social Security benefits. Medicare is really the sister program, and like Social Security benefits, it's paid for out of tax revenues that are generated through your payroll withholdings. When you take a look at that paycheck, that 7.65% or 15.3% that you pay, part of that is going to Social Security, the other part is going to Medicare. Now, last week we talked about the requirements to qualify for Social Security benefits, you know, the ages of which those benefits come into play, the amount of those benefits. Now we're going to talk about Medicare. Who's eligible? When do those benefits start? And how much do the benefits cost? Or here's one that you really need to pay attention to. How much is covered by Medicare?
I think this gets a little confusing, Jim, because some of these government programs have different sort of start dates or eligibility dates. We talked last week about Social Security and about how your full retirement age is 66. Well, just to make your life a little more interesting, your Medicare eligibility starts at age 65. So if you're 65 or older and you're eligible for Medicare hospital insurance, which is also known as Part A of the Medicare program, you're eligible if you receive Social Security or railroad retirement benefits, or maybe you're not getting those benefits, but you worked long enough to be eligible for them, or if you would be entitled to receive benefits on your spouse or your divorced spouse's work record, and that spouse is at least 62, or if you worked long enough in the government job to be insured for Medicare. Now, just like with Social Security, there are situations in which, even though you're under the eligibility age, you can still be eligible. Examples of this are if you're under 65, you become eligible for Part A if you get Social Security disability income and have Lou Gehrig's disease, or you've been an SSDI beneficiary for more than 24 months, or if you've worked long enough in a government program to be eligible for those benefits. And again, a lot like Social Security, if you are a widow or you are someone who is disabled, regardless of age, you can also become eligible for those benefits, usually after a 24-month qualifying period. So kind of similar to Social Security, you don't have to be 65 to qualify. There are some other eligibility requirements that can make you eligible a little bit earlier, but that's kind of the basic. 65 is kind of the cutoff for enrollment in the Medicare program.
And outside those special situations that you just mentioned, there are deadlines, by the way, that are very important to roll for Medicare Parts A and B. If you don't enroll prior to the deadlines, you may end up paying a 10% higher premium. The longer you wait, let's say you wait a year or 2 years, that premium goes up and it doesn't get reduced when you sign up for it. So there's a 7-month window during which you must enroll for Medicare Parts A and B, or you're going to end up paying this higher premium. Now, the 7-month window starts 3 months. This is very important. It starts 3 months before you turn age 65. So if you really think about it, the window of 7 months begins before 65. Once you turn 65, it's really a 4-month period. So this includes the month you turn 65, and it goes until the end of the 3rd month after you turn 65. So if you missed your first personal enrollment window, you can enroll during a general enrollment, which happens every year between January 1st and March 1st.
I think this is kind of a surprise to a lot of people. I know people I've talked to have been, really? I get penalized if I don't sign up in time? But yeah, if you don't sign up for Medicare in time, they start to penalize you. Even if you're not actively using those benefits, you need to be enrolling for them during your eligibility window, or they will ding you for that. I think another fuzzy area with Medicare is actually cost. We hear debates all the time about what does Medicare cover? What does it not cover? About how it covers way less than the actual cost of care, mostly coming from physicians groups. But what about the cost of the benefit itself? It's not exactly a free benefit, even though we've been funding it for lots of years through our payroll deductions. So what are some of these costs involved with actually being enrolled in Medicare? What comes out of your paycheck or your retirement check in order to pay for Medicare? And I think probably the first thing to do is to sort of make some sense of all this Medicare alphabet soup. There's Part A, there's Part B, there's Part C, there's Part D. What do all these alphabet letters actually mean? So basic Medicare coverage is what they call Part A. And all Part A coverage does is deal with hospital stay expenditures. That's all Part A is for. Part B is medical insurance. Thinks about things that normally your employer's healthcare plan would cover in terms of doctor's visits, etc. So Part B is really kind of your equivalent of medical insurance. Part C is what they call Medicare Advantage plans, which we'll cover a little bit later. And Part D is the prescription drug plan. So A is hospitals, B medical insurance, C Medicare Advantage plans, and D prescription drug costs.
And when we talk about Medicare Advantage plans, a lot of seniors like this because they're offered by private insurance companies. They're approved by Medicare, but each plan can charge different out-of-pocket costs, just like any kind of insurance policy you would get. And they have different rules in terms of how to receive services. So you must have parts in A and B to enroll in Part C, which is Medicare Advantage. Now, some of these plans include prescription drug coverage, so you won't need, for example, Medicare Part D if your plan already covers that. But it's the same with this Medicare Supplemental Insurance Medigap. Medigap policies do not work with Medicare Advantage plans. Now, there's a Medicare Plan Finder tool on Medicare.gov. So you can explore these options available because they're different in different cities and different states. So I would check out the plans, use your zip code, and take a look at what those plan premiums are going to be. They vary from basically nothing to $182. Now you can add Medigap coverage, which is not part of Medicare, but is fully offered by, let's say, private insurers. But once again, you have to go to Medicare.gov. It's called Medigap Policy Search Tool. Put in your zip code and the health status just to get what those higher costs are going to be and get the Medicare plans and find out which, you know, some of these plans can cost up to as high as $312 a month.
So Jim's been talking a little bit about the Medicare Advantage programs, which are Part C, and Medigap programs, which are not part of Medicare at all. They're supplemental to the Medicare program. He talked a little bit about those costs, but what about your basic Medicare coverage? If you're looking at Part A, which again, let's remind ourselves, is just hospital coverage, most of us out there are not going to pay a Part A premium because we've been paying all those wonderful Medicare taxes the whole time we've been working. Now, some of us are not eligible for that benefit, and if you're not, you'll be paying $441 a month for Medicare Part A. Now, the other part of Medicare that everyone enrolls for is Medicare Part B, which again is the equivalent of medical insurance. So Medicare Part B for everyone out there is going to cost at least $104.95 a month. If you make more money than that or you're at a higher income bracket, you can end up paying an additional $230.80 a month, which is a total monthly premium of $335.70. You also can sign up for Part D, which again is prescription drug coverage. And those prices start at $66.60 per month. And again, if you make more income, you're going to pay a higher premium for that. So for you, it's going to cost a lot more. You can end up paying as much as $402.30 per month just for your Medicare costs.
The point that we're trying to make here is you really need to do your homework on both Medicare Part C offerings and Medigap insurance, because if you're thinking about picking these up, because sometimes what you're going to pay differs widely in terms of premiums for the same type of coverage. So I guess the old adage, go out and kick the tires before you buy a plan. And if you do a Medicare Part C option, which is Medicare Advantage, Medigap coverage is redundant. You're going to pay for something that you're really not going to get any benefit. So review the coverage for overlaps before you decide to buy.
What about medical costs in general? So we covered Medicare costs and Medigap costs as well. What about other medical expenses that might happen in retirement? We've quoted some numbers from Fidelity Benefit Consulting before, Jim, and they have an updated number for the 2013 costs of care for a couple that retires at age 65 this year through the end of their lifespan. Fidelity Benefits Consulting is estimating $220,000 that couple will spend on health care coverage during their lifespans. This is just, again, a heads up on this number, this $220,000 number. It does not include costs associated with nursing home care, and it only applies to retirees with traditional Medicare insurance coverage. So what this Fidelity Benefits Consulting figure is telling you is that even if you have Medicare already, you're going to spend an additional roughly $220,000 on expenses outside of your Medicare expenses during the course of your retirement years.
And that's not unusual when you consider the fact that people are living longer. I mean, you just take a look at the cost associated with bypass surgery, treatment of cancer. Genworth, an insurance company, has done an estimate on the average cost or care numbers. For example, home health aid or assistance runs anywhere between $18 and $19 an hour. Adult daycare is running about $65 a day. Assisted living is averaging somewhere around about $3,500 a month. And a room in a nursing home between $207 and $230 a day, that's the average cost. Some states, like my own state of California, and in some areas along the East Coast, there's probably a lot higher. So the cost can vary. We're just talking about averages here.
Jim, I was thinking, we've got clients that I know pay $6,000 or more a month for their living situation here in San Diego. So I know that this number Genworth is quoting at $3,500 a month, I mean, that's kind of low for out here in California.
Yeah, there is a retirement community. It's one of those communities where, you know, your meals are served, you have an apartment, and they also have a medical wing in case one spouse gets sick. And, you know, the average per couple is about $6,000 a month. So when you think about it, that's $72,000 a year. So it can be quite expensive. It's a very high price tag. In some cases, well, a lot of our clients that are in these homes, they say it's worth it. They like it. We just had a client who pays around this amount for her living situation in a very vibrant facility. And when her husband got sick, he was moved over to the other part of the facility so she could easily visit him. It's not like you have to take off, get in the car, drive to a hospital, hospital hours. And more importantly, when he got better, he came back to their apartment in the facility. So for some couples, the ability to move, let's say just once, into one facility and have everything handled for them, if you can afford it, including the need to, let's say, have stepped up care, is well worth the extra cost. So you see a lot of people, for example, will sell their house. Some of these places, to keep the cost down, require an upfront investment. Some of them, that will not go to your estate when you die. Others have, a, let's say, a higher cost getting upfront that you have to put up. but then you build some equity so when both spouses pass on, there's something that's left for the estate.
We'll be talking a little bit more about the different costs involved with some of these different living arrangements in retirement and how to fund those in upcoming programs. But I just want to give an example of some budgeting for some of these medical costs we've already talked about in this program so far, Jim. I'm thinking about this couple we met with recently who's in their early 60s, so they're getting really close to retirement. And we were doing some retirement income planning with them. We got to looking at their budget numbers, and right now they're spending about $200 a month on different medical costs because a lot of their medical costs are covered by the insurance programs they're in at work. So they're only spending about $200 a month on medical care right now. And they let us know that a lot of this was just out-of-pocket costs for visits to their doctors, their premiums for their insurance copay, basically, and testing and prescriptions. So that was kind of their current health care cost number, was about $200 a month right now. So we went over to the other side of the ledger and looked at what they had sort of ballparked for their possible health care costs in retirement, and they bumped that up to $425 a month. This was more than double what they had already been spending on health care. And so, you know, I think doubling that number in retirement was not a bad move on their part, but we got to thinking that maybe even doubling that number for them was a little bit lowballing that number. We talked to them about what their plans were in terms of Medicare and Medigap coverage, and they were going to be paying the usual Plan B costs of $104.90 a month, and they plan on picking up some Medigap insurance, which was going to run them about $312 a month. So that got them to about $417 a month. So, you know, their $425 estimate a month was pretty close to this particular number. But this number that they came up with, this $425, really didn't include things like things that Medicare doesn't cover, didn't include things like unexpected huge medical costs. You were mentioning heart problems, or there's cancer that we're going to talk about later on today. So we asked them to bump up their monthly spend number for medical coverage to around $550 a month, and to earmark around at least $150,000 of their retirement savings for unexpected medical costs that they would incur during retirement. So based on our recommendations, they decided to go ahead and keep working a few more years to take advantage of their employer health benefits and also to save up a little bit more money for this nest egg we asked them to sort of put aside and earmark it for healthcare costs in retirement.
And what this is really emphasizing, it brings up an important phase to really focus on, which is Medicare approved, since the charges at the time, and it's doubtful, for example, that Medicare reimbursement for health costs will even come close to keeping up with inflation in the medical area. I mean, just take a look at healthcare premiums. If you're working, you're seeing more and more companies. There was an example last week where IBM announced to 110,000 of their retirees that they're saying, you know what, we used to cover this. You were included in the medical plan, but that's not what we're doing in the future. We're going to give you a block number. It's going to be a figure. And you're going to have to take whatever that number is, and you're going to have to go around and shop for your own medical coverage. And it's not just IBM. Caterpillar's doing that. And a lot more companies are jettisoning their retirement plans, healthcare coverage. And they're basically saying, look, we're going to give you something, but we cannot sustain. IBM basically came out in their statement to their employees and say, our present plan will not work. It's unsustainable. And I think you're going to see more and more of this going forward.
I think this just circles back again, Jim, to how important it is to sort of keep revisiting your retirement plan and your income plan in retirement, as well as your spend plan in retirement, and to have a little bit of extra tucked away for medical costs. You know, you and I have been covering these government benefits last week and this week about what the government provides, mostly so that our listeners can put some real dollar signs on some of these programs and not think of them in sort of very rough, generic terms, but just get down to some nuts and bolts of how much these programs either cost or will pay out to you. Because again, the basic of doing any sort of a retirement plan or budgeting plan is you have to know how much is coming in and how much is going out. I think, again, Jim, it's really good to emphasize one more time that your out-of-pocket expenses are going to be affected a lot, not only by your premium costs for Medicare, but again, keeping in mind that Medicare will only cover so much of each procedure you have done, of every doctor visit that you do. And if you don't have some kind of supplemental insurance, that non-approved cost is going to be coming out of your pocket. So you want to keep that in mind when you're planning for these medical costs in retirement. I was also thinking, Jim, I'm sure a lot of our listeners may not just even know what they're eligible for in terms of benefits. There's a great government website out there called benefits.gov. Plug in a whole lot of your information in there. It'll spit out a whole list of benefits that you're eligible for and when those eligibility dates roll around.
Yeah, so the more that you can spend time, whether you go to socialsecurity.gov, medicare.gov, or in this case, benefits.gov, at least familiarize yourself with what's available, when you qualify, what the amount is, so you can do some proper planning. I mean, once again, that's what we talk about here in Lifetime Income. Have a plan. And one thing that we have found neglected in many, many retirement plans is healthcare costs. We just don't think of it because many of us either, well, you could be working for the government where you're covered. You work for a company where there's a insurance plan and maybe you have some deductibles that you have to pay or co-pays, but all of this has been sort of taken care of. We're moving further and further away from that, just like we moved away from defined benefit pension plans beginning in the late 70s and 80s. We're also moving away from government and companies covering full medical coverage, as I just cited here with the recent announcement by IBM, Caterpillar. You even have Starbucks and some other companies that are all announcing this movement away from this. So very, very important that you have a plan. So anyway, one of the things that I'm sure we're going to be talking more and more about that and sticking with this healthcare theme that we're covering today, and also about preventive care. Coming up next on the program, I'm going to be speaking with Dr. Georgia Sandler. She's a clinical professor of surgery at UCSD's Moores Cancer Center. We're going to talk to our listeners about cancer risk and prevention. She's coming up right after this. Joining me this week on Lifetime Income is Dr. Georgia Sandler. She's clinical professor of surgery at UC San Diego. And doctor, as we look at the statistics of most Americans, the three big killers causing death are heart disease, cancer, and diabetes. We're going to talk about cancer today, and I'd like to get your thoughts on it. When you think about cancer prevention, I know, for example, in heart prevention, exercising, watching what you eat, when you get to cancer prevention, what are the practical things that people can do, and how much does genetics come into play here?
That's a great question. So probably the most important thing we can all do is not smoke and not be around people who smoke. So primary inhalation of tobacco smoke and secondary inhalation. Those are really easy things to avoid for most people. In California, for example, we've had great success with reducing the smoking rate, which reduces secondhand smoke and overall is starting to have a very positive impact on our cancer rates related to tobacco. Other things are using sunscreen products when you can't avoid the sun and avoiding the sun whenever you can. So those are another good example. Melanoma is a very lethal cancer. Basal and squamous cell are less threatening cancers to one's life and well-being, but they can be very disfiguring to treat. So those are three skin cancers we'd like to have people avoid developing. Other cancers, like breast cancer, we really don't know what to tell women, and even the smaller number of men who develop breast cancer, how they could have avoided it. So the answer for them is be sure to follow the screening guidelines. They do change from year to year as we have more scientific evidence to hone our guidelines more closely to the best possible outcomes, and then follow them. So if you're supposed to have a mammogram starting at age 40, which is the current recommendation, for heaven's sakes, make it your birthday gift and get a mammogram if you're a woman. And then continue doing that every year for the rest of your life, because early detection of breast cancer can save lives. The same with colorectal cancer, cancer of the colon or the rectum. We know that after age 50, just as with breast cancer and prostate cancer, the risks of developing those cancers increase. So an ounce of prevention in terms of early detection can prevent a lot of longer-term morbidity related to the treatment, but also can save lives because early detection can be life-saving. Since you're a financial program, of course, early detection means less expensive treatment. And that's also an important consideration as we try to get the most out of the healthcare dollars that we spend.
You know, Doctor, you mentioned something, staying out of the sun, which is, you know, for those of us that live here in California near the beach and the ocean, we live here for those very same reasons. We like to spend a lot of time outdoors. You just take a look at the number of golf courses here in California and then, you know, go to the beach on the weekends or out on the bay. It's full of people taking advantage of our weather and sunshine. Are there things that you can do, you know, things obviously like wearing clothing with UV protection, sunscreen, things of that nature, which, you know, most of us don't think of?
Absolutely. You're absolutely right. Wearing a hat that really covers not just your forehead, but the back of your neck. If you look at a man who's been exposed to the sun a lot, you'll see there's a line on his neck where he gets a lot of exposure above his shirt and less exposure below his shirt. It's a really easy way to see the impact of the sun on our skin. So wearing protective clothing is the most important thing, along with wearing sunscreen that's at least a 30, 35, 45, they go on up to 85 and beyond. So the fairer you are, the more skin protection you need. And it's important to realize many of your listeners may be coaches on Little League teams or run Girl Scout troops. Children who have darker skin still need protection from the sun. And sometimes they need even more protection because the darker the skin, the less easy it is to see it becoming pink from a sunburn. So all children need to be protected when they're out in the sun. And then the other thing we can all do is try to do our outdoor activities before the peak of the sun, so before 10 a.m. So get an early time to do your golfing or your boating activities, do your gardening before 10, or preferably do them after 2 or 3. It's a lot nicer because the weather's not so hot, and it's going to be less damaging to your skin.
You know, Doctor, what about, you know, we've been told by the medical profession, one of the things you can do for heart disease is watch the foods that you eat, your diet, also exercise. What role does, let's say, diet and exercise also come into play when it comes to cancer prevention?
The really good news here is that all the things you do to protect yourself from heart disease are believed to have protection against cancer. They can also be helpful in coping with cancer treatment and the residual effects of cancer and its treatment. So some people find they feel tremendously fatigued after cancer treatment or during cancer treatment. And exercise, modest, not being a hero, but reasonable levels of exercise have actually been shown to benefit and help with the coping with the fatigue. There are dietary things that we recommend, lots of fruits and vegetables, lots of whole grains, lowering the amount of sugar you eat, lowering the amount of red meats you eat. All of these things protect you against multiple diseases, not just one. So you're getting a much bigger return on that investment for better eating.
So healthy foods, exercise, keeping one's weight down, avoiding sugar or trying to minimize sugar and keeping the weight down, it sounds like if you practice that, it works for both heart disease and also cancer as well. What about things that we're hearing more and more, things like the China study, vegetarian type diets? We've seen, for example, former President Bill Clinton, who had quadruple bypass. He had stents put in. Now he's vegetarian, kind of looks as thin as I've ever seen him.
Yes. So the key thing here is moderation. I don't think we have yet complete proof that avoiding red meat entirely is essential. But moderation. You know, you go to a restaurant and they give you a 16-ounce steak. That's enough for me for 4 days. And that 4 days of meat might happen over a week or two. So it's moderation. It's not necessarily saying don't eat anything in this food category, but it's moderation. And the same with the amount of calories, because the more we eat, the more weight we put on, and that affects multiple diseases, including diabetes, for example. So the bigger the body, the more your insulin has to be produced to service that body, and then we end up with more and more people having the early onset of diabetes. So all of these things that you hear, certainly practice them in moderation. And if you feel that you can follow them in whole, then that's fine too. There's nothing right now that says vegetarian diet isn't a good diet, provided you are an informed eater. Many vegetarians don't know how to produce or prepare a balanced meal. And that's as worrisome as someone who's eating huge amounts of red meat. So the informed listener is going to be your truly healthiest listener.
Yeah, because there's a lot of confusing information out there. You have things like the paleo diet, the South Beach diet, the Atkins diet, the vegetarian diet. We now have vegans. And doctor, have you found that what diet works depends on a person's body chemistry? I mean, there are people out there that, for example, just can't handle being a vegetarian. They need more protein. Maybe they're athletic. Is there different diets for different people?
I'm not sure there are different diets for different people in the sense of body chemistry, but certainly some people can follow one diet and someone else can't. And so the most important thing is look at the guidelines, which would be 5 to 10 servings of fruits and vegetables every day. That's important. So figure out how are you going to get in your 5 or 10 half cups of cooked vegetables or your 5 or 10 full cups of raw fruits and vegetables each day. Start with that and then build your meals from there. I suspect if you start with the healthy components first, things will fit in a more reasonable way. It's when we start with this big monster serving of meat and then we don't have enough room left for the other important parts of our diet, the grains as well. Whole grains are really important. White grains are not necessarily healthy grains. The brown whole wheat breads, you want to be buying products where whole wheat, when you're buying grains, whole wheat should be the first item on the list of ingredients. That means there's more of that ingredient in that product than anything else.
So if we were to sort of put this in order in terms of priority, and before we do that, I want to get to the part of genetics. What role does genetics play in the likelihood of one, let's say, dying of cancer? Because I think of George Burns, who died, gosh, what was he? He was almost close to 100 and smoked a cigar every day. Or you take somebody like Winston Churchill, who not only drank during the day, but also smoked a cigar.
Yep, that's called cognitive inconsistency. What we see doesn't make sense. And so one of the challenges is, for most of us, we see people who smoke and they don't get cancer or they don't develop emphysema. But if you looked at the data, you see that, yes, 9 out of 10 people who smoke don't get these terrible diseases, but 9 out of 10 people who get these diseases were smokers. So it's playing the odds. You're saying, well, what's my family history first? So if you have a family history with most of your relatives dying of cancer, that's a very different family history than most of your family members dying of syndromes related to their diabetes. So looking at your family history is the first place to start. Now, in the decades ahead, we're at this very exciting age in genomics where we're going to have a lot more information than we have right now about the nation and about people individually, about groups within groups. So it'll be easier to more appropriately develop not only lifestyle guidelines, but even treatment guidelines. We're going to be able to really individualize cancer therapies, for example, based on the tumor's responsiveness to various treatment options. So we're now entering this very new age of personalized medical care, not only in terms of what we should each be doing, but in terms of how the diseases that we develop will be treated. But it's not going to necessarily change our basic understanding that we should get out and walk more. You know, the American Cancer Society is always telling us 10,000 steps a day. How many of us really do it? It's hard. It's really hard. So you've got to park your car farther away from your office, park at a distant point in the grocery store parking lot. Find little tricks, play little games that get you to achieve those goals of healthy eating and enough exercise every day.
This new era that you're talking about, we heard about, for example, genetic DNA mapping, something that Angelina Jolie has brought to the fore with, I guess she went through it and decided to have an operation as a preventive way of possibly preventing cancer. Is this what we're more likely to see going forward?
I think so. Angelina Jolie has been the beneficiary of not only cutting-edge science, but she was a lucky person. The science really spoke directly to her personal health history. Not everyone is that lucky. So she had the benefit of being able to make a decision. It was a life-changing decision. It was a huge decision. But she had the luxury of having that option. Most of the rest of us don't. In the future, most of us will have more options. And so we're looking at going forward. It's one of the challenges with all the budget cuts on cancer research right now, because here we are poised to make incredible breakthroughs. And yet the number of grants that are being funded with high scores is diminishing. So it's a harder time to make scientific progress. And we're at this great breakthrough opportunity for the future. So it's a challenging time for scientists. I'm sure that you can understand that one.
Is it something that we're more likely to see in the future? As we all know, it's very important once a year to go in and get a physical checkup with your doctor. Is it possible with either insurance or as part of that physical, they'll have that DNA makeup, so it'll tell you that the diseases you're predisposed towards, is that more likely to be incorporated, or is that something that will be paid for separately or could become quite expensive?
Well, I think it's certainly part of the future, and it's an exciting part, because if you think about it and you know that, let's say, you are predisposed to developing breast cancer, as happened with Angelina Jolie, she had choices she could make. If you find that you are predisposed to having diabetes, you have lifestyle choices that you can make. So this will be a very important way of decreasing our cost of healthcare, because we can at least delay the onset of a disease, if not prevent it entirely. So that should generate cost savings to the healthcare system. But just the idea that we can take control has a monetary mental value to me. If I know that if I do these six things, I can avoid these 24 diseases, I'm willing to make that investment in my life. And I think it will put more of us in the driver's seat of being able to make those give and take decisions. And I think with our new health insurance, we're also going to see fewer health disparities. Most people that have the opportunity to explore these kinds of options have more financial assets. They have better health insurance. They have more discretionary funds. But if we don't have a health insurance plan that will help the whole nation, we're still going to have not only the disparities we have now, but greater disparities. So the new health insurance plan, while it's causing all of us to think deeply about how it's going to impact the delivery of health care, how patients will get into the system, how the system will work smoothly for the next 2 or 3 years during this transition, it's going to be a huge benefit to our nation, because it will finally level the playing field and begin to reduce some of these terrible health disparities that we see in our country.
So, Doctor, if you were to sum up in terms of priority, in terms of cancer prevention, I think number one is looking into your family genetics and history, because that'll tell you about your likelihood or the percentage that you could contact or come into the disease. And what would be the other priorities if you were to put them in order?
I think the next one would be getting families to talk about these issues. Really sit around the dinner table or sit around on a social afternoon and really talk about the family's history. In many families, this is not done. And so diseases like diabetes, high blood pressure, heart disease, cancer risk are not discussed openly. So I think that's one thing that families can do to help each other, to really sit down and understand their medical history and then figure out what it means for each individual personally. The second thing I think that could be done would be to talk outside of our families. If I stand on a street corner in a community that's different from my own, and I spout off about why it's important to get a mammogram, no one's going to listen to me. But we have research projects, for example, that we've done with African American beauty salons here in San Diego, and another with Asian grocery stores here in San Diego. We're training the stylists to get the message to their clients. We're training our Asian American Pacific Islander students to take the message to the Asian grocery stores and talk with the shoppers as they come and they go. So trying to get communities to raise their own health literacy levels, because knowledge is so powerful. So moving this discussion from the family to the community and getting people to talk about it. Those are really, really important messages and far more effective than a billboard on the side of the street. If your colleague tells you, remember, you're going to be 50 next month, don't forget about your colonoscopy, and that's someone who really cares about you, you're much more likely to pay attention to that than to a billboard on the side of the street. So I think those are the important things. And then the other really big thing is to look at where you need to do financial planning in relationship to these life-threatening illnesses. You know, one is we need to think about if we have a terminal illness and the best of science can't fix it, we need to have the kind of financial planning and sense to get through that last phase of our lives successfully. And unlike many other diseases that strike suddenly and fatally, cancer gives you months to years to decades to live and get your house in order, take care of your personal business. So it's an opportunity to have a really good, clean, smooth, positive ending to one's life. And we're all going to die someday. So having the opportunity to do it well planned, I think, is one of the blessings of cancer in contrast to being struck by a truck or hit by lightning or a fatal stroke or heart attack. And then the other thing is to be thinking about long-term insurance. What do we need to buy while we're still healthy? So health insurance, life insurance, disability insurance, long-term care insurance. These are all parts of financial planning that really relate to cancer, because if you have these really important elements in place, then the challenges of dealing with cancer, which are huge, will be at least only the challenges of dealing with a disease, not the challenges of a disordered financial household. So I think those are really important things for your audience to consider. And then just the self-responsibility. We just need to all take charge. And we have enough knowledge right now to prevent or find early more than 50% of all cancers. So there's no reason why we can't each individually contribute to lowering both the mortality rate for cancer and also the morbidity rates for cancer. How serious is the disease when it's found? So it's a chance for us to each of us get involved.
Finally, Doctor, is there any place where a lot of this information could be made available to our listeners where they can actually find out the very things that we talked about, whether it's detection and prevention, taking a look at hereditary backgrounds, diet, exercise, things of that nature?
The two best websites are the American Cancer Society's website, cancer.org, and the National Cancer Institute's website, cancer.gov. There's also help on the phone at both of those organizations. The 1-800-4-CANCER is the National Cancer Institute's phone line, and then the American Cancer Society is right there in your hometown. Get involved with your local cancer society. The American Cancer Society has lots of services that the healthy can help them to deliver to those who are less fortunate. So they have a driving program that helps people find their way to their next doctor's appointment. Many people don't have children nearby, or their spouse has to work, or they will lose their job and their health insurance if they take off too much time. So both knowing where to go for help, but also being willing to give it back to your local community, those are both equally important agendas.
Well, listen, Doctor, I want to thank you for joining us here on Lifetime Income. A lot of useful advice. And once again, the top websites you would recommend for our listeners?
Cancer.org for the American Cancer Society, and cancer.gov for the National Cancer Institute's website.
Well, listen, Doctor, thank you for being so generous with your time. I'll hope you'll come back and talk to us once again.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
On behalf of Kathleen Harris and myself, Jim Poplava, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on Lifetime Income. And do make yourself available to check out some of those websites. You know, do yourself a favor. A lot of this, whether it's heart disease or cancer, is preventive. And the more you know about your own body's health and steps that you can take to correct that, the longer life and more fuller life you're going to have. So until we talk again, we hope you have a pleasant week.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense NewsHour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSN. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense NewsHour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the NewsHour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense NewsHour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense, or arising out of the use of any material on the NewsHour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.